Okay. Hey, it works again. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the last ASAP meeting of this year. We have two new members and representatives, Lin Zhu, representing both China and AOSSG, right?
Yeah.
And Jae Woo Kim, who is here on behalf of the AOSSG, correct? Yes. All right. We have no administrative session,
no,
so we can go straight into business. And we're going to talk about primary financial statements. So to Michelle.
Okay, well, there are three main papers for this meeting about improvements to the statement of financial performance. And these papers were all discussed by the board in November, and the board's tentative decisions on the papers are included in Appendix C of the cover paper, which is paper one. Now, at the November board meeting, the board took about 3 hours to discuss the three papers. We only have 1.5 hours today, so I plan to keep my introductions quite short to leave time for the discussion. So I suggest starting with paper 21A. On the staff proposal to introduce a new category, income and expenses from investments, into the statement of financial performance. Now, introducing the investing category was recommended by some ASAP members at our July meeting. And the board has tentatively supported the staff proposals in the paper to introduce this category using a principles-based approach together with illustrative examples. However, the board was mixed on the presentation of the sharer associates and joint ventures and was not supportive of the staff recommendation to label the subtotal before this category as operating profit. So do ASAP members have comments and questions on Agenda Paper 21A?
To give it a start, Andreas? Yeah.
Why not?
You look very energetic.
I'm good at screwing up. So starting with your two issues that you just commented on the very last, I had the pleasure of observing the board meeting, so I had all the fun. And I would say that I probably personally would have landed in a different end, and I would have gone with the subcategory of operating profit. I think if people believe this is not operating, operating is something else, I think that you will find out probably regardless where you land, whether you include something, whether you label it differently. People will come up with a starting point, and I think if people are looking for that, this to me is a sensible way of going forward. And I mean, we're talking about a discussion paper, propose it, and then see what the reaction will be. On associates, I also had a different leaning. I think in the board meeting, Nick quite elegantly said, I understand the thrust of the discussion. However, this is not how analysts treat the line today. They want it outside of operating. I probably have a very split view on this one because conceptually, I believe that there's actually two kinds of investments in associates. So there is that classic financial investment, so to say, where you just hold a strategic investment and that feeds you some dividends. And I think that should not be part of operating. However, if you are in a holding-like capacity, rather than investing into the individual assets and taking on liabilities yourself, but invest in an associate and have all the streams come through, then to me, the character is much more of an operating nature. So I would have gone basically with two lines. If this is not really digestible for analysts, I would stay with where I landed at the last ASIF meeting and said, disaggregate further. So have two lines and then the analysts decide where they want to put it, but disclose it. And whether you do it on the face or you do it in the notes, my preference would be to do it on the face, but this is where I would have landed.
Can I ask you something, Andreas, because I've thought a lot about our discussion afterwards, not least because we sort of landed with a no decision one way or the other, so I'm trying to think of the arguments we need to sort of develop for the discussion paper. One of the points I think that Nick made at the meeting, Nick, tell me if I'm misquoting you, was the risk of sort of upsetting ratios if you were to put this sort of unique equity investment number sort of with operating because it upsets the normal metrics because it's an aggregated number. So I just was interested in your thoughts on that. And also the other thing I've sort of thought about after the board meeting is whether or not, given that by definition you can only have significant influence over an associate, whether that means we should necessarily be thinking about it differently. So these sort of arguments that I know I hear a lot, not just in the building but outside the building, about the fact that you've got some sort of pure investment type associates and then you've got some that are more integral. Can you really have something that's so integral if by definition you've only got significant influence over it? So you're a smart guy, so I wonder if you've got any thoughts on this.
Okay.
How long was that for?
No pressure.
but briefly, just because I have to think about it more thoroughly as well. I think the construct of significant influence is something that we adhere to, but I think similar to the concept of control that we employ for consolidation is based on some assumptions. And the question whether or not there really is significant influence being exercised, I think, hinges on the number of facts. I think this is our construct, but whether there really is significant influence enough to change decisions, for instance, to make something integral so that you say you are the single most important shareholder, you have a huge free float and the likes. I think it is difficult to come up with a final judgment, but in the end, I wouldn't say I would care so much about destroying metrics. I know that this is about destroying beliefs, but I think on this side, I have a great deal of problem with the analyst community and in loving their ratios. But I think probably with false assumptions as to what these ratios really portray, because there are other underlying assumptions, and if you meet them, then the metric works. If you put in different input factors, I think the entire information logic changes. And whether this means that you need to adjust your metric, I think the least we could do is probably highlight that this has an impact on your ratio and think twice before you just discard it or include it.
I, by the way, I liked your idea of putting some focus in the discussion paper on the alternative of calling it operating profit, mm-hmm. using the nomer operating profit. I don't know if the staff had already planned to do so, but I think it should be mm-hmm. mentioned as an alternative. Kim?
Thanks, Hans. Yeah, I certainly am supportive of the investing category. The thing that I'm just not too clear on is the distinction between the sort of investment income that's in there and the interest income that is sitting in the eye in EBIT, and perhaps I'm a little bit confused then as to the interaction with the cash flow statement, where we there tend to make the distinction between interest income and interest paid, and at the moment. I mean, my understanding is all interest income would be sitting under, well, the choice at the moment, operating activities or investing activities in the cash flow statement. Yet, if I'm reading this, we're seeking to still put some interest income, is it on the excess sort of cash, in the financing income space, and then we're putting other interest income and other income in the investing activity, category. I'm not quite sure if I can really see then sort of some of the logic and the connectivity there. The other concern with the investing category is that at face value, you would expect it, well, if it's been called investment income, you would expect it to only be income. Yet, I don't know, it's not really clear whether or not we would also have, for example, fair value losses coming through in that line, and it looks like we would have fair value losses. So again, I think maybe the description of investment income sounds a little bit misleading as to what really is in there. So
we changed that, didn't we, in the board discussion?
Yes, I think we would need to clarify that it would include the losses as well.
Yeah.
Regarding your first point, what we've got in the I in EBIT is it would be the interest on the cash and cash equivalents only. and the other interest would be in the investing category. And actually, as part of our papers for the December meeting, we're bringing a paper looking at the cash flow statement. And while we don't expect we're going to have a complete alignment between the investing categories there, we are looking at the classification of interest in the cash flow statement in December.
Yeah, so I think that there needs to be a good rationale to say, well, why put some interest in the financing and put other interest income in this investing category? Otherwise, that distinction could be a little bit artificial as to, you know, that's why I was thinking that, you know, if at the moment, like the distinction in the cash flow statement, you've got investing and then there's the financing, is that sounded like, you know, good distinctions to differentiate between those. And then on the share of the profit or loss of associates, yeah, I think just following on from some of the comments that Sue made, you know, I think that if we buy into the fact that, yes, you've only got significant influence and that this is effectively a measurement of your investment, then I think that it probably should be in this investing category, because by definition you don't have control. And so, you know, yes, you have more influence than you know, a 5% holding or something like that. But I would say that it's still a measurement of your, you know, of your investment and should be in the investing category.
Andrew?
Thanks, Hans. Just picking up on the points made by Andrew and Kim, first of all. So in our discussions with our technical expert group and consultative forum of standard setters, the point comes up repeatedly that perhaps defining or giving more clarity on the line items will take some of the pressure off trying to find agreed ways to define additional subtotals. But overall, I think the message is these aren't mutually exclusive objectives, and there is merit in defining additional subtotals, even if some people might want to still adjust those as a so-called anchor point. On the investing subcategory, I'd say the overall tone was one of cautious support, but with plenty of emphasis on the caution at this stage. I think it's sensible to focus for the time being perhaps on commercial entities rather than investment companies, lessors, property investors, banks, insurance companies. But there's a certain trepidation is at some point these currently excluded entities need to be brought back into the fold, and how the thinking that's developed at this stage in the process is going to then affect the entities that we don't have in mind at this stage in the process. And the point about the fact that a number of groups these days do have financial investing activities as part of broader operations comes up repeatedly, so that's just something to hold in our minds. The point on the potential tension point, I think, between an investing category and the interest line item, it's also had lots of attention. I would say that people are reserving judgment on whether it's sensible to use the return on cash and cash equivalents as a proxy in the way described in the paper, especially where companies are investing surplus funds as part of their overall treasury management policy and might more think of this as being related to their capital structure. So that's come up. If we are focusing on straightforward commercial entities, then the question came up as to what actually is going to be in the investing subcategory, in many cases apart from income and expense from associates and joint ventures. And of course we're talking about significant influence as well as joint control when we talk about this line item. I would say views were very split on whether there should be a single line item for equity accounted profits and losses, or whether it does make sense to follow what you might describe as a business model approach and try and make a division between whether they are somehow core or integral or not, and make aspects. So possibly the discussion paper could explore the pros and cons of both alternatives, but I think cautious support is the overall message.
Jay Ho?
Yeah. I want to make a comment on question one of agenda paper 1A, so about investing category. AOSS members showed mixed views on the creation of investing categories into the statement of financial performance. Among others, some members have concern on inconsistent definition of investing between the statement of financial performance and the statement of cash flows. This will lead investors to confusion. These members think the users want to see comparable and cohesive information across different financial statements as well. So they suggest the ISV should align the definitions of investing between the statement of financial performance and the statement of cash flows. In a similar vein, one member raised questions about whether the proposed definition of investing would be broader than that of cash flow statement, as the staff reasoned in paragraph 46 of Agenda Paper 1A. It should be noted that paragraph 16 of IS 7 says the cash flows from investing activities represent the extent to which expenditures have been made for resources intended to generate future income and cash flows. To illustrate, cash payments to acquire property, plant, and equipment are arising from investing activities, but the future cash flows generated from that are deemed to be arising from operating activities. I think this reasoning would be more consistent with the commonly held economic sense. That is to say, investment in facilities and then revenue from that. So in contrast, the definition of investing proposed in the agenda paper goes against this common economic sense and appears to narrow the scope of investing down to financial investment, excluding fiscal investment. To make it short, the expenditure on asset acquisition is not necessarily coming from the same activities as the return on the expenditure. Unfortunately, the proposed definition of investing seems to be an attempt to forcibly align the expenditure and its return within the same category. Thank
you. Christine?
Good morning. Thanks. So, first of all, with respect to scope and the decision to focus on straightforward non-financial entities, our staff that are working on our performance reporting project expressed some concern for many of the same reasons as you expressed about the need to bring the financial entities in at some point. And I think given they had gone down a similar path and had run into some roadblocks based on their experiences, they did not find that to be a successful approach. That said, now speaking for myself, I actually think it makes a lot of sense to try to go down that path first. It's either going to be the case that we can come up with one model that works for both, in which case you can bring them into the fold once that model is created, or there is simply not one model that works for both, and you'll have to work on a separate model for those financial entities at some point. And trying to do them at the same time, if there really is not one model that works for both, just means you're going to keep running into roadblocks. So speaking from my own perspective, and not having lived through whatever pain they lived through, I can I can say that I would agree with the approach that you're taking. With respect to separating between operating, financing, and investing, there was some discussion in 21A and 21B about the point at which you do the bucketing. Do you do it at the level of activities to define what is financing, what is operating, and what is investing, at the level of activities on the income statement? Or do you do it at the level of assets and liabilities and then flow that through the income statement and the cash flow statement? And it sounded as if, based on some concerns about difficulties that you might run into on trying to do that bucketing at the asset liability level, that there was some preference for doing the bucketing at the level of activities on the income statement. I'm not sure that that's going to ultimately end up being any easier than trying to do it at the asset liability level. And the one advantage, I think, of trying to figure out what the bucket should be on the balance sheet and then flowing it through the income statement, cash flow statement, is if ultimately we want to work towards cohesiveness of financial statements. So there is a logic as to how information flows from balance sheet to income statement to cash flow statement. there will be, I think it'll be easier to tell the story if you start with the balance sheet than if you start in the middle and then try to push it out either way. And there's been different comments that have come up about the cohesiveness between the income statement and the cash flow statement. It's just one example of that. In terms of distinguishing between operating and investing, I thought there was a really important sentence on page 6 of 21A, where you were discussing some information or some input, I think, that you had gotten from investors as to why they analyze cash and cash equivalents and other liquid assets separately from operating. And so the thing that I think is really important that you note there is that with investing activities, one of the reasons why investors like to separate those out is because they don't have the same need for forecasting future cash flows as they have for the operating activities, where things are being generally used in combination to produce future cash flows. And so I think that, to me, helps a lot in thinking about how should we distinguish between what goes into the operating activity bucket and what should go into the investing activity bucket. If I can take a step back and ask the question, would fair value measurement provide sufficient information for a user to forecast the cash flows that are going to come to the entity from the use of that asset, then it's most likely an investing activity. And if the answer to that is no, it wouldn't be sufficient, then it's more likely to be an operating activity, not thinking about financing right now. I think what that question then highlights, though, is that there is an interaction between measurement on the balance sheet and presentation on the income statement. And we're just talking about presentation, but it's very dependent then on getting the measurement right, so to speak, on the balance sheet for those types of assets. In terms of the operating level, I, similar to Andreas, I think, had no difficulty with that residual category at the top being operating activities. That fits better with my own thinking, which is why I'm probably partial to that. I think that the recurring, non-recurring distinction is more an issue of disaggregation within the operating activity category, as opposed to the need for a separate subtotal. And last but not least, with respect to the investing and financing overlap, I understand what the staff is trying to accomplish, but I do think some of the concerns that we've heard around the table are going to make it very difficult from an operational perspective. If you even just look at the definition in 21A, paragraph 23, where you have the language in there to try to define the investing activity section, it says investing income and expenses or income expenses from assets that generate a return for the entity individually and largely independently from other resources held by the entity. Cash and cash equivalents meets that definition. So I think it's going to be really hard for you to write a definition that is going to make it clear that certain things that meet that definition don't belong in investing, but in other further reasons would end up in financing. It's going to create the difficulty that Kim mentioned about the income statement versus the cash flow statement. So it would just be, I think, cleaner if we thought about the investing section as being assets and the financing section being liabilities, and used the definitions for the investing section from paragraph 23, the one that I just noted. And then you had a really nice discussion in 21B, paragraph 46, I think it was, where you talked about what financing liability looked like. I think that does a really nice job of giving us a way of thinking about what should go into the financing category. And it would be a much cleaner partitioning, may not be perfect. Nothing we do is ever going to be perfect, but I think it would be more operable and clean up some things that might cause some problems down the path. But overall, I thought really a nice set of papers. I think you're on the right track, and I encourage you to keep going. I look forward to seeing the next draft.
Okay, thanks, Christine. Linda?
Thanks. So echo a few comments that people have made, but I'll start out by saying that we haven't tested these papers, these specific papers, with our user advisory council. We will. But I've probably in the last year spent much bigger proportion of my time with users, so I feel like I have a sense of where they're coming from. But some of these concepts we have tested in the past. So in general, very supportive of trying to create some definition around an investing category, financing category. I want to just also comment about the scope out of financial institutions, given my background. I think that's probably a very pragmatic approach, because you're going to get, if you try to do it otherwise, you're going to get mired in, does this really apply to financial services, which may impede you from other progress. But I also think you should be using your time that when you start developing these proposals further to actually test them with how would they apply in different types of industries. And I think that's really important to do, because in talking to users, there's always these little industry practices that people think about when they develop their metrics. And I'm thinking in particular this notion of, if you do this, are they just going to create a whole new set of non-GAAP measures on top of that? And you try to actually increase the relevance of the financial statements. So when you're getting, what, either before you do the discussion paper, or as a result of doing the discussion paper and you're doing outreach or you're asking questions, think about how this would apply, for instance, in oil and gas, how it would apply in mining. There's software, there's real estate, because we're targeting more of those types of discussions with the notion of actually trying to define where they think it's different, but there's actually a more overlap than what they think. And that would lead you to a way to talk about it in their language, which would help them see that there's more overlap and that maybe they don't need all these alternative measures. And so I just caveat what else I say with regard to that. So again, big support, but we think that some discussions and testing needs to take place. Specifically with regard to the notion of where you present the share of profit or loss from associates and JVs, I know even going back to the transition when we were dealing with that, we finally landed on saying we're going to put it all in one place and we're going to make it really obvious where we're going to put it, because that's what our users wanted. But in that context, that was a tiny part of the business and made no difference in any of our metrics. And so I am intuitively, while the staff is saying, our staff and our initial outreach is saying, you know, put it all in one place and then let the users decide what they want to do with it, I actually like the notion of thinking about how significant it is to the entity. So let me give you an example. So in financial services, it was tiny, it didn't matter, it didn't change, but that was in the specific situation I was in. There's other businesses, and I'm going to use oil and gas as an example, that they go out and they do lots of activities through JVs or through associates because they want to test a marketplace and they want to see what the opportunity for growth is before they go whole hog, okay? Or there may be government reasons why they can't go in any bigger than that. But it's an integral part of their growth strategy, and it's an integral part of how they're spreading risk. So that really has a big influence on kind of the trajectory of their growth as a company going forward. And so you can argue whether or not that's integral, but I go back to the notion of defining segments. And in the past, when I was in high tech, because everybody thinks I'm a banker, but I spent a big part of my career.
You also did some useful things.
Yeah. Would agree with it, but anyway. But when we were looking at a new software, for instance, and we knew that that had the potential, I already started thinking, when did I need to break that off as a separate segment? Because even though it might not be material at that point, the growth prospects were going to mean that it could very quickly become material. And so all I'm trying to say is, I like intuitively the answer of just put it all in one place and maybe give them enough information to disaggregate if you need to. But I wouldn't give up on the notion of integral yet. I would test it. I would discuss it maybe in the discussion paper and ask questions. You can decide whether you want to do it before the discussion paper, after the discussion paper, whatever.
We have decided to do the proper place in the discussion.
But I think you need to at least explore it and give them some rationale between how you would differentiate it. It may not all be based on math. It may be based on growth prospects and things like that, okay? So I do encourage you to do that. I think you should be, I agree with Andreas entirely, I think you should be bold with this notion of an operating profit. Let them push you back. Let them say, no, this isn't going to work, and this is why it's not going to work. But I'm becoming more and more persuaded in this area of financial reporting, that getting more information into the financial statements at a greater level of disaggregation is going to actually make a difference. And so I think you should be exploring these ideas. In terms of an investing category, a wee bit of concern that we overcomplicate this. So if you ask users, their answer would be, just give me the number on the cash flow statement in the P&L. I'll be happy. It'll be simple. I don't think that's necessarily correct, but I think that's what many of them would say. But to the extent that you then overcomplicate it by layering and layering more things into what you would call interest, or in the sense that you can't make it conceptually clear, this is why I'm calling this investing, and this is why I'm calling this financing, that isn't intuitively appealing, then you're just going to give them another reason to tell you why this isn't relevant and they need more measures. So hopefully you can find something midway between the cash number and an overly complex number in terms of defining that.
Good, thanks. David.
So in New Zealand, we conduct some outreach with our technical resource group, which largely consists of large accounting firms. And they were generally supportive of a principles-based definition of the investing category. However, they did express strong concerns around a rules-based exception to this treatment of the share of profit or loss from associates and joint ventures. Their preference was for you to continue to explore this integral, non-integral split, and a suggestion was made that whether an indicator could be how active the entity's involvement was in that entity, so whether it was an active involvement or a passive involvement. In terms of investing category and financing categories, similar to other comments, they expressed concerns around how this might interact with the cash flow statement and confusion there, and whether further work needed to be done to explore whether change to be required to the cash flow statement categories, because they quite liked the categories that we had here. And one comment that really came through was don't confuse comparability with uniformity. And I think that came through quite strongly, especially when you're talking about this one line item for share of profit loss from associates or JVs. And in terms of this subtotal operating profit, there was very little support for using that terminology, and they would rather a more accurate description like you'd outlined in the paper.
Okay. Noble?
Yes, thank you. We have three comments. One is an overall comment that applies to this paper as well as the next, is that we think this project should address only presentation, and therefore should not affect any recognition or measurement decisions. But some of the decisions that are tentatively made seem to maybe not directly change recognition and measurement, but still attach some meaning to how accounting should be made. And we think those are controversial, not very straightforward, and therefore we strongly recommend the ISB to stick to the current recognition and measurement requirements.
What are you
for example, the equity method investments, how to present them. I think it's how you view the accounting is and how that would be presented. The other is the interest costs related to defined benefit pension obligations and how that should be presented. That depends on how you look at the accounting for those in the first place. And I think your decisions to put it in this certain place seems to imply a certain way of looking at it, which we think is controversial. So, but we understand that some decisions might be need to be made to move this project forward. And if that is the case, we would recommend the ISB to set it as a temporary measure. One of the users in our technical committee mentioned that if the debate on where to put these equity method investments, gains or losses, is controversial, he would agree to put it in one place for the time being until you have a comprehensive review of the equity method of accounting. But that still would be a temporary measure. My second comment would be on this equity method investments. And we've been told by our constituents that significant influence does not happen by accident. It is an explicit decision to obtain significant influence, and therefore most investments made in equity method investments are integral to the business, and therefore if we are to use this distinction, most would go into this operating type category rather than the investing category. And we also are not so concerned with the effect on the ratios. A third comment is on operating income, and we have a different view on how to define operating income, and we would like the ISB to consider an approach to define operating income directly, not as a residual, taking out financing and investing out from net income. We think it's difficult. If you're saying that operating income or this operating income type subtotal is useful, it should be directly defined rather than being derived backwards from net income. People, you read the income statement from the top, and if you want to see something that says operating income, it should come down from there rather than taking up items down from the bottom. Those are our comments.
So does that mean you'd agree with the label that we...
For the label, we have a different... We would try to take out these one-off items from the operating income to call it operating income. We our view is operating income should be some kind of sustainable income that comes from operating activities that take up these unusual or infrequent items. But we know it's a
difference. Here comes the complexity.
Yes.
Yes, but if we think of operating income as the most useful subtotal, we would try to go there.
I think this for me
where the most abuse takes place, yeah, in non-GAAP, and for us to define that, I mean, we can. We are still going to address whether we can give guidance.
Because I think there's two slightly different things. One is, given that we've sort of so far at least decided on defining things that are sort of financing, to use a loose term, and investing, and then we've got this other thing, because we've reached that conclusion, is it appropriate to call that other thing operating, or should it have a different title,
yeah,
or should we start off by trying to directly define the operating? So those are sort of two slightly different things. Yeah?
I'm not sure
which one you were suggesting.
And I think the big reason why we haven't gone for the operating is exactly the point, I think, Nobu, that you were making, that you personally would actually exclude the non-recurring items from the operating. I think there are probably others around the table, and certainly when we talked about it in the World Standard Setters, who wouldn't exclude those non-recurring items. And actually reconciling those two very strongly held differences makes it incredibly difficult to go down a route of trying to directly define operating.
And one of the difficulties we had in this paper is your distinction between core and non-core, and you seem to be saying that financing and investing all are non-core, and we don't see it that way. We would separate operating or non-financing, non-investing items into core and non-core, but we wouldn't think all financing and all investing would be non-core.
Whereas I didn't think we were trying to get at core and non-core, rather thinking that there were particular things we wouldn't naturally think of as operating at all. But I think the reason why, and I'm interested in the sort of alternative thoughts, I guess, on what we should label the thing that's left over.
Yeah.
Once you've taken out the financing and the investing bits, what it should be labelled. But I think one question is, should we be brave and just declare it as operating? But I think some of us probably don't think we've tried to get to an operating profit metric as such, because some people would think the operating profit is a much more core and not concept, and we haven't really gone there. So it's not just that we're not being brave, it's just that we're trying to do something slightly different, I think, objective-wise. But I appreciate the different views.
Lynn?
Thank you.
We think that the feasibility of introducing a new item of income or expenses from investments rely on the clear definition of that item and also the clear boundary of this category. It's all right to have a principle-based definition, but currently the proposed definition does not capture all the features of the investment category, or else I don't think we wouldn't, I think we wouldn't have the dilemma of 21A3 trying to decide how the share of profit or loss of associates and joint ventures should be presented. And I think it would be helpful for the staff to give clarification on the examples on the last page of the agenda, paper 1A, why the rental income is listed as the investment category, and why the disposal of PPE is not a investment, is not in the investment category in the statement of financial performances. And also on the share of profit or loss of associates and joint ventures, we think that it would be more accurate to present it according to approach B, but if you really look into the definition of the income or expenses from investments, we don't see why it doesn't meet the definition. And also consider the considering all the complexity and the judgment involved, we think we agree with approach A. And on the operating income, well, in the past, the board tried to define the operating profits, but it was not very successful. And if we are trying to define it now, I think we are going to meet the similar problems, and we'll have to deal with the definition of frequent, infrequent, occurring, recurring, and non-recurring, or things like that. So we agree with the item named profit before investing, financing, and income tax.
Patrick?
Thank you, Hans. Two comments. The first one, I think that those papers really represent a very interesting effort to try to capture some of the elements in the P&L. I think it is in line with the efforts which have been dedicated in a number of jurisdictions to have financial statements that reflect a common presentation and therefore can be used for comparability. Mm-hmm. So I think it's going in the right direction. However, I think the bottom-up approach, i.e. trying to identify some elements in a P&L, has its limits. In other words, if the ultimate goal is to try to define some sort of operating performance, which I think is what the analysts would be looking for, and maybe the users in general, the bottom-up approach is not sufficient. Therefore, yes, it's interesting to move bottom-up by trying to eliminate is not the right word, but to define some of the lower elements in the P&L in order to approach the upper part of the P&L, which is for me the essential part of the P&L. Before reaching any conclusion, the recommendation which I hear from my constituents is that we should maybe have a more holistic view before any finalization is reached. I think that's remark one. The other remark is that, yes, it is interesting to work on the category, the investing category, because by definition, the I in EBIT is a mixed bag of a number of things, and therefore you have a level of leeway about what is being included in it or not. So I think it clarifies, but once you have clarified what is not I per se and is IN, investing category, then you still have a question, which is the status of that subcategory. And quite frankly, there is a level of hesitation between what is core and what is non-core. I take, for example, the case of the share of profit or loss of associates and joint ventures. In certain cases, it is really almost operational. In other cases, it's not. So it's complex, and without killing this category, should we, as we do in our jurisdiction, leave a choice, an option, you know, or should we say it is in the investment category, and the investment category is in this position? I think it's a bit too early to finalize this. So these were the two remarks which we wanted to make,
which has been voiced by many others around the table. Andreas.
Thanks, Hans. I just want to come back on the debate we are having, and that started with Nobu's suggestion to go the other way around, not to define operating as a residual, but rather directly.
Yes.
In peeking ahead, I think if we look at what the product of this project is likely to be, which is a discussion paper, I would really like to see it being a discussion paper and not a position paper. So I think if there are at least three approaches, one being defined directly, second, define as a residual, third, don't define anything, let the user decide and go the disaggregation route, then I think you should be exploring at least to a certain degree all the three approaches, discuss their merits and their disadvantages, and then probably come to a conclusion based on what you have researched so far, which may then lead to the approach that you're currently investigating as being your preferred approach. But I think it would be a shame if much of the discussion would just be left out because you had it internally on the board and would not let the audience really participate in that debate. And I think it would help greatly to see the three approaches aligned, so to say, and see their advantages and disadvantages being discussed.
Kim?
Yeah, I mean, I was just going to give my comments on labeling that category. And I think that my personal view, and I think thinking about a lot of preparers' comments, would be is probably to not define that as operating. And so I think that sort of, well, calling it what it is as opposed to the residual is by definition operating. But I certainly share Andreas's comments that I think for the purpose of the discussion paper, I really think that it would be good to put forward the different alternatives and the different arguments to put it out there, because I suppose, you know, it would be interesting to see. I mean, is it the analysts who are wanting that specific naming versus, you know, preparers who I would imagine are not wanting that particular name? Because the interesting thing, I suppose, would be is if there was a definition operating profit, because preparers typically refer to operating profit, if they're not referring to the defined term, is it just going to be, well, it's the adjusted operating profit, or it's core operating profit? And it's so, because I think, you know, typically operating profit is a term that most companies use, yet there certainly are inconsistencies in how those are calculated.
Can I just ask the staff something? Well, firstly, we haven't made a formal decision on whether it's a DP or an ED as the next step, right?
No.
Although I could have my own personal guess where we'll end up.
Yeah.
We haven't formally decided. And secondly, we have left open whether we're going to circle back and try and do something about a management operating profit metric, right?
Yeah, so bring that to the December meeting.
Yeah. So we may still have a separate discussion on a directly defined number or some description, although it may be management can define
that. That would be a self-defined number.
Yeah. But then we may have two competing operating profit metrics if we tried to do our own definition and allowed a management one. So I think we just need to remember that ongoing stream of discussion.
I mean, to sort of build this up into a bigger picture and to sort of bring in the December papers as well, what we're trying to do with our approach to this is look at the different ways that investors actually analyse different types of information and sort of separate them out. So we know that typically they want to take the financing stuff out and look at that separately. We know that some of these investing ones, they want to analyse separately from the cash flow from, to use a shorthand, from operations. We also know that they also want some sort of information about the recurring, non-recurring nature, which gives rise to a lot lot of the non-GAAP type information that's produced. And some of the papers that we're talking about in December are looking at, well, how can we go about providing that additional information about recurring, non-recurring, which I think might get to some of the points, Nobu, that you were making about sort of perhaps a core, non-core distinction, although maybe not going quite as far as that. So that's our sort of master plan for the project, to try and get to these different ways in which entities, in which users analyse the information and provide that information as much as we can within the confines of the primary financial statements.
Christine.
Responding to something that Nobu said, and I'm going to maybe put words in his mouth, so if what I'm about to say is not consistent with what he was thinking, but it jogged something in my mind that I was thinking when I was reading the paper, and that was when he mentioned that there are potentially some implications for recognition and measurement. When I was thinking about this issue of integral versus non-integral, if we really truly believe that economically those are two different situations, then it's a much bigger question than just presentation. There's actually a question as to whether they should be accounted for similarly or not. And so assuming we're not going to go down that path of trying to figure out what the recognition and measurement differences should be between them.
Sorry, but why would that be the case?
Because the information that you're getting from the share versus you could do a proportionate consolidation, you could do equity method accounting, you could argue for fair value accounting if it's non-integral. So there's implications there that if you assume you don't want to go down that path. Okay. He's, I know, I can understand why you're getting to it. But anyway, what I was going to say was, when I was reading it, if we assume that we're not going to want to go down that path, then I was more inclined to say, let's just put it one place, put it all in one bucket, and allow for the management to explain their business elsewhere in their MD&A and their description of their business or whatever. That to me is not a completely satisfying answer because of the sorts of things that you brought up in certain industries where it is very much a big part of their business, but if that's true, then just showing a net balance right. isn't exactly informative. So anyway.
Linda?
I just wanted to reiterate, whether you go DP, whether you go ED, don't underestimate the process you're going to go through from an education perspective. So in our discussions with the users of information, they say, I make this kind of adjustment because of this. And then when we start probing on how much they actually know about that particular item in terms of the underlying accounting, okay, what we find is if they actually really had a I don't expect them to be experts on every area of accounting, but if they had a better underlying understanding, they might not actually be making that adjustment. And so that's why I'm saying I'm kind of supporting what you're saying. I like the notion, Andreas, of if you have three alternatives, talk about them, because you're going to get an education effect from having that discussion. And clearly, if this, you know, I can easily see that if this comes out and you have that kind of approach, we would be all over that from getting users to really work on that in case studies and saying, you know, this would be this approach, this would be this approach. Don't estimate the value of just elevating the educational understanding of what's happening here, because I think you'll have a more successful outcome if you do that.
Just a quick one. I also share the view, of course, that revisiting categories and trying to introduce subtotals should not be an opportunity to change recognition and measurement. I think we need to bear in mind, and that might be a transition with our next topic, that, of course, we have already the statement of OCI, which is reflecting some differences in net dual measurements, and as a consequence, we need to be careful when we operate at P&L level to make sure that we do not overlap with the statement of OCI and that we have a clear distinction, because in fact what we are creating is in fact three categories,
operating performance, IT, other, and then further down somewhere, OCI.
Below.
So that's interesting. Yeah. But and quite frankly, the only recommendation that I would have is to stick to concept that people understand. And you know, there is a level of acceptance. I agree that operating profit is not defined properly, and that some people make and they adjust, or anyway, they would be tempted to adjust even on the basis of a definition. But I prefer a definition and a clear adjustment than a label which is in fact used in a different way by different people. So I think that the objective again is the top-down approach, because the most important part of the P&L is the upper part, rather than a detailed explanation of what you don't take into account, because the creation of value is a combination of all the common expenses above those elements that we are trying to isolate at this moment. Okay, you have to start somewhere. So starting bottom up is fine, as long as you finish top down at the moment in time.
Okay.
Moving on to paper 21B. We have heard some comments on 21B already. The proposals in paper 21B are very similar to those that we brought to the ASAP meeting in July 2017, except we have narrowed our definition of finance income and expenses slightly in light of having an investing category. And so we think that the interest on assets that do not arise from financing activities or part of cash and cash equivalents would go in the investing category rather than the financing income. However, our description of the line items is also different, and we've moved away from the term capital structure, as some of you suggested at the July meeting. We've also shown a separate line item for effective interest on cash and cash equivalents to reflect the IFRS 9 requirement for entities to present separately interest revenue under the effective interest method. And for a similar reason, we may want a separate line item for impairment as well on the cash and cash equivalents. We've also avoided using the wording interest to refer to the unwinding of the discount on liabilities outside the capital structure, to avoid a potential conflict with use of the term of interest in IFRS 9, which has led to the somewhat more or slightly less descriptive wording of the finance income and expense. Now, the board was supportive overall of the staff proposals in the paper, but noted that we may need to work on the wording of the five line items in the paper. So do ASAP members have comments or questions on agenda paper 21B?
Yes, thank you, Hans. Reading the proposals, that we observed that there might be diversity in how entities would interpret the definition of financing activities, and also how to apply the definition of cash equivalents. I think there's more or less a policy choice on what goes into cash equivalents. And at the same time, I think you're saying that this EBIT type subtotal is intended to provide comparability, and we would like to know what level of comparability you're actually looking for, because if you provide more room for interpretation, it's more likely that you get less comparability and then the distinction between this management performance measures that you'll be talking later will get lost. So do you have any idea on what level of comparability you're aiming for?
Your question was what level? We're looking very much to try and get the EBIT subtotal to be as comparable as possible, which means I think that we're looking to be as restrictive as possible or as clear as possible in our definitions of what goes into the eye of the EBIT. And I think part of the reason we went for cash and cash equivalents was we thought that that was a relatively narrow and relatively well understood term. But if you're seeing practice where there's diversity in what's been classified as cash and cash equivalents, we'd be interested in that, in your feedback on that.
So the initial feedback we received is that for three investment of the 3 months or less, entities have a choice of, based on their view of whether that is a cash equivalent or not, is more or less their judgment. And under this proposal, those that don't go into the cash equivalents will be in the investing category, more or less. So then that would, in our view, impair comparability and whether that is really useful in terms of having a comparable So we weren't sure if you really want to go more stricter or not.
I think the key to comparability is the operating level. That is, it's at that point that's absolutely key. So in some respects, beneath that is about labelling and where items fit. So I'd be less concerned in that respect.
Andrew?
Thank you. And we continue to support exploring, defining an EBIT subtotal. It seems, based on current discussion, is the most tractable of the subtotals, if I could put it that way. I think this paper is very much on the right track. It makes sense, from my point of view, not to, in the definition, not to use the term capital structure, even if that terminology was useful in shaping the thinking that went into the paper. It's probably rather too theoretical to end up in an accounting standard, I'd suggest. I think the definition perhaps needs a little bit of work, because it seems a bit circular to define finance income and expenses based on five items, the bottom two of which are other finance income and other finance expenses. But I know when you go into the paper, you say what you have in mind. That's hopefully the final definition will be a bit more sort of direct. I made the point already that there's some questioning around whether it makes sense to treat cash and cash equivalents as a proxy for some broader category that you might call the management of liquid resources or reinvestment of surplus cash in accordance with a treasury management policy. I think perhaps a discussion paper could explore different ways of looking at this issue, and I'd suggest quite possibly if we can get a principle right around management of liquid resources or something along those lines, that would not necessarily be a detriment to comparability, as it will just accommodate a different range of treasury management policies. And on that note, in a particular point, there is some legislation coming down the track in Europe which will affect both the description and the mechanics of certain money market funds in due course, 2019, and I think this may put some more pressure on whether certain funds meet the definition of cash equivalents. It may not at early stages, but it's worth noting that could put further pressure on using cash equivalents as a proxy for some wider category, but overall seems on a good track.
Andrew's comment about EBIT reminded me of something that came up in the research forum in Australia that I was at a couple of weeks ago, and what I was surprised by, but it's interesting, was a great love for the EBITDA subtotal rather than EBIT. And I'm not sure personally I'm convinced, but that reminded me that I think sort of aligned with what Andreas was saying before, we probably need to talk about why we picked EBIT as opposed to EBITDA. If that's what's going to be in the document, just so people can react to whether that was the right decision or not. And I think arguably you could say if you can see depreciation and amortization, it's easy to get to the other subtotal if that's the one you're more interested in. But I think it would be, we've sort of got into the position of assuming that's the one that we should go for, and we probably need to explain why.
Also in the pod discussion paper on principle of disclosure, we considered whether we should be looking at EBIT or EBITDA, but that EBITDA wouldn't fit in a bifunction income statement.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's flying through to acceptance down under.
We made to fit.
Warren Buffett has always said that managers that use EBITDA should be immediately fired.
Okay. Thanks, Hans.
Yeah, so just referring back to the comment I made on the first paper, you know, I really think that we should not be including interest income in this eye. I think we should, you know, put the positive returns in the investing, and we should put, you know, interest expense in the financing. So you know, not really supportive of the cash and cash equivalents interest. The other thing that I also did find quite interesting was the discussion on the net interest on the defined benefit liabilities and assets. And I suppose the question would be is, well, if you did have a net defined benefit asset and you had interest income, you know, again, why is that a financing activity? And I suppose the other thing could be is, I could see why the net interest expense on a net defined liability could be regarded as financing, which then also takes us into some of the other discussions around the decommissioning liabilities and other long-term liabilities, etc. And I think that I'd like to have a consistent concept that if we've said, well, you need to be reflecting the time value of money, I mean, isn't that effectively then, you know, financing? And shouldn't we be treating that consistently? So if from a recognition perspective, we've got the discounting to reflect that, then why not treat it in that way from a presentation perspective? So I think I would certainly put all of those, you know, unwinding of discounts and financing, etc., all in the financing line. And then the other thing that I also found interesting was, at face value, I wouldn't have thought that we would be putting Forex gains and losses in here. But I did see some discussions around saying, well, we would be. And I suppose maybe, again, there needs to be some you know, greater clarity as to, well, which Forex gains and losses would be included in this financing income line. And then also things like derivatives. So if, for example, and again, is that then dependent upon whether or not you're applying hedge accounting, or is it, you know, independent of whether or not you're applying hedge accounting? Would we see fair value gains and losses on certain derivatives that relate to financing liabilities also being included in this I? So I think those are some things that need to be looked at.
J-Ho?
I'm uncomfortable about using the term financing income expense to define and calculate EBIT. The way I see the agenda paper, the concept of financing income expense appears to be broader than interest income expense, so as to encompass even foreign exchange gains or losses and fair value changes on liabilities arising from financing activities. I wonder whether this is really how users of financial statements interpret the EBIT measure. As usual, may put their focus on interest itself, I think using the term interest income expense would be more plain and effective in satisfying users' information needs as to EBIT. Also, looking at IFRS standards, I observe that IFRS 9 and IFRS 15 are already referring to interest revenue and interest expense literally. In spite of this, if the ISB is determined to proceed with the term finance income expense, I suggest that when the ISB mentioned the components of finance income expense, they should separately and prominently list interest income expense from different sources, including defined benefit liabilities, and then lump all the others, such as foreign exchange gains or losses, in one component. Just look at the step recommendation as set out in paragraph 35 of the agenda paper. There is only one mention of interest, and even that mention is only for cash and cash equivalents, not for other assets or other liabilities. I think this goes against a general perception that interest makes up the staple part of finance income and expenses. That's my comment.
Christine?
Thanks, Hans. So back to what you were saying about EBIT versus EBITDA, I think that if that issue does come up, that a strong argument can be made for there being an economic basis for focusing on EBIT, because financing of the business, so the interest portion of that, is separate from the value creation activities, which is above that. Whereas EBITDA is just, as I think Hans was saying, sort of a back of the envelope CFO, you know, cash flow from operations proxy that some folks use but doesn't really have an economic basis. So I think from an economic perspective, you can make a strong argument for EBITDA and say EBITDA does not have the same economic basis. With respect to the decommissioning liabilities, the defined benefit, and the excess cash, so the questions 2 and 3, I think that when I look at the description that's provided for the nature of a financing activity, and back to paragraph 46, you can make the argument that pension obligations meet those characteristics. If you view the employee and the retiree as the counterparty to the transaction that are expecting a return. So I think that you can fit pensions into there. I don't think you can fit decommissioning liabilities in there. And the question then for me becomes whether or not decommissioning liabilities and the interest on those really belongs in this category. And I just fundamentally don't feel that it does. So I would, if you know, we were discussing this at the FASB, I would not be supportive of putting the interest component related to the decommissioning liabilities into the financing. That would also make life easier for us because the SEC requires that interest component to be classified as operating, so we would run into some problems for public companies if we were to go down a different path. But that's really not what's motivating my reaction to that. It's just that I just do not view that as financing expense the way that I do the other components. And then, again, just echoing what Kim was saying on the interest income, I just think it's cleaner to have that in the investing category. I'm sympathetic to what the staff and the board are trying to do with identifying excess cash because that is a really important concept in valuation, but it is a really difficult one for anyone to get their hands around. It was one of those topics when I was teaching valuation that, you know, you just do the hand waving and say, well, it's there, but we don't, you know, we don't really know how to measure it. And so I think that if we're going to err on the side of doing anything with that notion of excess cash, simpler is better as opposed to trying to get really specific around something that's just a very nebulous notion.
David?
Probably just 3 points. So the first point is, as I mentioned earlier, support a principles-based definition, and the topic of this excess cash not supporting a rules-based exception, if I could call it that. So in our jurisdictions, quite a lot of feedback that a lot of entities make, if I call it poor investment decisions and just hold on to a lot of excess cash as such, but really it is an investment for them. And lastly, probably a question around those line items. Are you proposing that those line items will be required to be disclosed separately on the face of the financial statements? Yeah, and if so, I guess in our jurisdiction we weren't supportive of that.
Could I ask why there wasn't the support for that?
I think that they felt that it would be more appropriate to provide that information in the notes rather than a mandatory requirement to have that on the face.
Okay.
I just would like to react on the discounting element for pensions, for decommissioning and things like that. I think there is an argument that a broader view to this should be considered, because to a certain extent it's everything which is interest related, and if discount rates are not interest related, then I have a problem. Should, in my view, be considered as an element of I to a certain extent. So I might not fully agree with you on decommissioning. In addition, certain liabilities have as a counterpart assets which are segregated. So it would be unwise, in my view, to have different treatment for the discounting expense, the expense related to discounting, and to and a different treatment for the returns on the portfolio of investment that you have organized to cover those liabilities.
So before concluding, I think we need to explore a little further, I think.
Okay. Thank you. We can go to the final paper.
Finally, paper 21C covers better ways to communicate information about other comprehensive incomes. The board had mixed views about our relabeling of the categories of OCI, although there was a slight majority support for the relabeling, but not for introducing the additional subtotal that we suggested. The board was also not supportive of developing education material for investors. So do ASAP members have any comments or questions on agenda paper 21C?
No.
Thank you.
I should define OCI. I know it by heart.
But actually, it's the other way around, and I need to say that you need to define profit or loss, and because you're not doing so, the improvements to this presentation would be limited. That would be our view. And two other additional points. The line item called income and expenses to be included in profit or loss in the future, in our view, would include remeasurements reported outside profit or loss. So it seems like the new name is not accurate in the sense. And so if the board were to change the names, I think you need to rethink of the name. And we understand you don't want to use other and things like that, but the label that doesn't seem to be communicating well. And in terms of the rejected subtotal, we think any subtotal that is useful needs to have the clean surplus relationship, but not all of them are really useful for predicting future cash flows. And in that sense, we think the proposed subtotal would not be useful, so we support the board's decision.
Andrew?
Thank you. Yeah, funnily enough, in our discussions, there was no objection to developing investor education material. unfortunately, there was no support at all or in these early discussions for changing the labels or adding additional subtotals. There's a great deal of doubt that would actually add any clarity. Perhaps there's also a bit of a subtext that this seems to be, to some extent, blurring the line, and the line has to be important in Europe in particular and elsewhere, for profit or loss. So not much, no support there. I think there's also the question about, is it worth exploring whether there's any demand for removing the presentation options, and I'm sure that's worth exploring. Let's see. One other point, though, the proposals don't include anything looking at the accumulated amounts in OCI, and yeah, we did note, as part of some other work, we've been looking very closely at the disclosures that are now in IFRS 7 in relation to the fair value through OCI category for equity instruments, and there are, I think, some disclosures that add a lot of transparency to what's going on and help to explain the accumulated amounts and transactions that have taken place. So I'm more hesitant, given other comments that we make, to say there's perhaps a disclosure solution to add transparency, but I think it is worth doing a bit of comparative analysis on the extent and type of disclosure for that category of OCI and comparing it to other categories and seeing whether there's something to be gleaned from that.
Andreas?
Thanks. Please don't treat this personal, but when I read the question above paragraph 5 and said, what is the problem, I would have used a different question and said, is there a problem? Because in reading the text, it seemed to be that almost half of the respondents don't seem to care about OCI straight away, and those that actually looked at OCI didn't seem to care what's in there.
Yeah.
So my question is, what problem is it that we are trying to fix? I could see some merit in this if we were focusing on future generations that we want to educate. Then I'd say, okay, for them probably it would be easier if we find better labelling. But for all the arguments that also were floated in the board meeting and saying that OCI is a cross-reference term all over the literature, so it's mentioned in the conceptual framework, for instance. So you have to update all these things. I think that gave me a very strong argument to say don't change it at this stage.
Kim?
Thanks, Hans. Yeah, I think based on some of the comments that have been made, you know, I think that if the revised wording is going to help and is going to be, you know, sort of more educational and informative, so that we're saying to users, you actually need to take note of this information and this is what the future impact's going to be, then make the change. I mean, if the feedback is, well, it's not really going to make any difference, then I guess, well, why make the change then? But I think that if the intention, it's going to achieve the outcome of making users understand that they need to be taking OCI into account, then yeah, I would certainly support it.
Patrick?
Surprisingly, I do not fully share the view about the lack of interest of new labels if OCI stays as it is. I think the track of trying to explain that we are talking about items which are future P&L profit and loss items is an interesting one, because I think it categorizes very well what OCI is about in terms of recognition following a dual measurement in most cases. So it's interesting. However, of course, as it was mentioned by Kim, the status of OCI is very unclear in general. We said it already around this table. Some people consider it an element of performance, other people consider it as an element of change in equity, and other people do not say what they think it is. So in general, it's confusing. So clarification, in my view, is needed from a broader perspective. But the labeling is interesting, because it avoids at least an element of confusion, which is to say it's performance not being profit or loss. So it's future performance. It might reverse at some point in time. It is reflecting two measurements, one from balance sheet, one from the P&L, which is a compromise. We all know that, between differing views about the measurement of a static position and flows. So to be explored. But again, I'm sorry to say it again, a more holistic approach, I think, is needed. Christine.
I think this is going to be the first time this morning Patrick and I have sort of just agreed on something.
We don't need to agree on the commission.
So I think it's interesting when you look at the feedback that you gathered from users about whether they pay attention or don't pay attention to OCI. And even those that said that they pay attention to OCI, pick and choose what they pay attention to, they don't pay attention to all of it. And I think that the reason why that may be the case is because we commingle two different kinds of things in other comprehensive income. One of the things that's in there does have implications for the profitability of the firm. It tells the user something. It's informative about economic comprehensive income to the entity. But there are other items that are in OCI that really are not informative of economic comprehensive income to the entity. Changes in the fair value of a liability due to changes in own credit would be a very good example of that. So I think until we have better clarity as standard setters around what is in OCI, which things are things that should be paid attention to because they are informative versus those that are in there because they're not informative, and a better way of segregating those two because they're mixed across the two buckets that are the not recycled buckets currently. That we run the risk of actually confusing users even more. So I think, you know, there's an old saying in the U.S. that you shouldn't put lipstick on a pig, and I'm afraid by trying to educate and by putting more labels on this that we might make the pig look more attractive than it really is.
I agree with you. And for example, we were to have this category of OCI that is never going to hit P&L. Mm-hmm. There are items in there which are economically extremely important, like pension liability.
Right.
And it might just encourage users not to look there at all.
Right.
So.
Or start paying attention to things that and they shouldn't be paying attention to.
And I agree with your division should be what is economically intuitive information and economically counterintuitive information. But that's not what we have.
No.
So labeling, I don't think, is going to add any value.
Yeah.
Lynn?
Thank you. I think the financial statement users do not pay great attention to OCI currently, not because they are concerned with the name, but because they do not understand the role of the OCI and the principles behind the requirements for recycling. I think so. So we do not think it's a good idea or it's so meaningful to rename the two category and introduce a new subtotal.
Linda?
Yeah, I want to kind of echo what Christine said. And the way I thought about this and in discussion with the staff, you'd have to, the hurdle I think you need to pass to go forward with this is to make sure you're not hurting anything. Or you're not deflecting people's attention from anything. So this notion of these arbitrary two categories, you know, they don't look at it now. They don't understand it now. If something you're going to do make that any better, maybe not. But if it makes it worse and portrays like you're giving more information, but it could be misinterpreted, then I question that. You need to decide. I mean, you're doing, I think, a lot of really good things in terms of the avenues you're going down. And so do you need to package this in now? Is it, I think you need to think through that.
David?
I think in terms of the relabeling, there was very limited support for that in New Zealand. I think a comment was, it'll help people better understand what recycling means, but it won't change any behaviour. In terms of this clean surplus total, there was even less support for an additional subtotal. But in terms of guidance, there was actually quite a lot of support for guidance, but not guidance to explain what is OCI, but rather guidance to explain why it's important that you pay attention to OCI. So maybe come up with or develop some examples that could quite highlight situations where investors need to pay attention to OCI.
Patrick?
One further comment. I am asking myself if, in fact, we shouldn't consider first what are those elements that are staying forever in OCI, because I think that one of the reasons for making a distinction is that some of them are staying there forever, quietly, under the blanket for the rest of their life. So, and I think that from a conceptual standpoint, it doesn't work, quite frankly. So I think that recycling, even if some solutions have to be considered from a statistical point of view, maybe, or yeah, I think that some solutions to recycle, all of them should be considered. And in this case, the status of OCI becomes clearer. Because at the moment, we are, to a certain extent, putting a bullet through our foot by saying we need to distinguish because there are two categories. But why are there two categories? The category which is not the category derived from dual measurement is a very ambiguous one, which I think from a conceptual standpoint, sorry to say it again, should not exist. So let's maybe see it through this angle first and then.
Okay, well, I think that was a very useful session for staff. Too long? There were a lot of good concrete suggestions, I think. All right, let's take a break till 1:45.